great figure in the time of troubles, the ancient Chinese time of troubles, and the kind of answer he gives to the political problem of the day. When the hour ended yesterday, you will remember, we were examining the system of Confucius, which reposed upon his own peculiar definition of righteousness and benevolence, those two pillars. Benevolence, at one point he says, is, in the following word, to be able to do unto others what we wish to be done unto ourselves. This may be called the art of benevolence. This is in Confucius. To be able to do unto others what we wish to be done unto ourselves. This may be called the art of benevolence. He couples, then, you will remember, the two principles of righteousness and benevolence, and from that, those two pillars, which he attempts to define, then he erects the structure of ceremonial rites. And we try to explicate the notion of ceremonial rites as empathetically as possible yesterday before the hour ended, pointing out perhaps what its critics, the Taoists and others, have directed against it, but also suggesting that it perhaps responds to something very fundamental about the relationship between the inner and the outer in human beings. That sometimes, before we can have an inner governance, so to speak, we have to have an outer rite or ceremony which dramatizes the necessity for an inner internalization, so to speak, of morality. And Confucius, then, you see, would say, as I think we concluded at the end of the last hour, that the notion of the Tao, of a return to the Tao, in any sense of primitive nature, nature defined primitively, is to violate the nature of man, which they think of as moving part way from nature, away from nature. At the same time, the Confucianist principle is trying to avoid the attempt to govern by force. In other words, unless we can internalize our morality and our standards and have some common standards, which he hopes to get through the principle of ceremonies, then we'll tend to turn to force. And force is disruptive, according to the Confucian. You can't have it both ways. So in a sense, you see, the Confucianist stands between. This is an oversimplification, but we're oversimplifying all along. In a sense, the Confucianist stands between the Taoist on the one hand and the honest on the other, because we want to say a word now in conclusion about the doctrine of Song Nong, which Suma referred to earlier as one of the three great theorists that we're looking at in ancient Chinese political thought. He's not the only one by any means. There are many others, but he's all we have time to treat. So we turn now, for a moment or two, to the response, then, of Sun Yan. Sun Yan flourished, we say, in the 4th century B.C., and hence is much later than either Confucius or Lao Tzu. But he's confronted by essentially the same political problem in the time of troubles. We don't know much about his life. There are certain stories or legends that circulate about Sun Yan. He came, it is said, from a ruling family and entered the service of one of the feudatory states. Becoming assistant to the prime minister of this state. When the king died, or the duke, rather, of this particular state, the prime minister advised the new ruler either to kill Sun Yung or to make him prime minister. There was no middle ground, said the prime minister, because he was dangerous, so to speak, unless he did have the highest authority in the state. Well, eventually he was exiled, and he entered the service of another state, and began to inspire, according to the legend, the new ruler with great ambition. For example, his legal system was so rigid and so severe, and he attempted to be so impartial in his administration of law that he applied it against the heir apparent to the throne when the heir apparent violated the law. Of course, this didn't win friends and influence people on behalf of the or from the entourage of the heir apparent. So when the heir apparent becomes king, you can imagine what would happen to, or becomes duke, would happen to Sun Yung. He's exiled then. And Sun Yung flees back to his old state, the state where he had been assistant to the prime minister. You see, Chinese scholars are always doing this during this long period of the time of trouble, swinging from one to the other and never finding complete refuge. We saw that true in the case of Confucius. And it sort of symbolizes the tension that exists between a thinker and a ruler, you see, in all generations. If you think at all, you're always dissatisfied with whatever system of rule you live under. Doesn't matter which. This is characteristic, it seems to me, of the thoughtful intellectual. Now, you can have the thoughtless intellectual, it's true. The thoughtless intellectual is one who fits into a groove and becomes a propagandist for the system of rule. And most intellectuals fall into that category, probably. But the thoughtful intellectual, as I'm calling them, Confucius and Sun Yung, will be in tension with systems of rule no matter what they are. And so it's not surprising then that when he comes back to his old state, he's driven back to another state. And they don't like him either. He's refused shelter, for example, and given no passport. And in the end, he's put to a frightful death through torture in 338 B.C., at least according to the traditional date. Well, so much for Sun Yung. Now, his own experiences may have affected his response to the time of troubles in that period. Basically, Sun Yung's theory is a theory of force, a force theory of politics. To be sharply contrasted both with the Taoists and the Confucianists, you see. Laws are to be made by an autocrat. And the reason why a state is respected and why a sovereign is revered is this force. Prosperity depends upon the use of physical force. The proper use of physical force. Now, Sun Yung is quite clear in his own mind that this has economic implications as well. He's very suspicious of the trader, because the trader, through his contacts with other parts of the world, will begin to undermine the notion of the supremacy of the state of which he is a part. And traditionally, there has often been suspicion of men of commerce for this reason, because they disrupt, they're constantly disrupting the order of the old state. At any rate, he concludes that the only two legitimate occupations which he attempts to get his rulers to sanction are farming and fighting.
The farmer is fixed to the soil. And it's difficult for him to get away. The fighter becomes the agent of the ruler for the expansion of his power. It's only under those circumstances when you restrict your occupation, which means that, in a sense, what he's doing is advocating essentially an agricultural society through the application of force in this economic context, that you can hope to get a restoration of order. Now, law, therefore, and this is perhaps the key to Sun Yung's exposition, law is the expression of force, period. Severe punishment is designed to abolish punishment. Sun Yung is full of paradoxes too. The more severe the punishment, the more likely it is that you will not have to use punishment in the future. And the educational system is designed to teach students, as one might expect, to do only one of two things, to farm or to fight. There are particularly no tradesmen, and no, what the translator put, no dialectics. Notice this. There are no dialectics. Now that term is going to be a key term, of course, in Plato and Aristotle. Broadly speaking, it means no discussion at all. No interchange. Although dialectics for the Platonist occupies a position somewhat more complicated than that, but this is part of its original meaning. So there to be no dialectics in the educational system. You're simply to be taught the two trades. I suppose one way of interpreting Sun Yung at this point would be to say that he is strictly against what we today would call liberal arts education. You're immediately put to the plow or to the sword. Now the state he regards as a kind of dynamic organism. It either expands or it dies. There's a certain amount of energy, he argues, in any body politic. And you either give vent to that energy, he uses this term vent, at least this is the way it's usually translated into English, you either give vent to that energy or the state declines. The state has to attempt to expand. And the benefits of conquest act as a kind of tonic to the state. Internally, he wants to make sure of the order based on force by dividing the whole country into family groups of 10 families, groups of 10 families, and then he establishes a spying system, a mutual spying system. Each group spies on the other. And no one quite knows who's doing the spying. Only the prince will know. Now, it's out of such principles, then, that he assumes that you will create an orderly state. I think these principles will be illustrated if we note some quotations from Sun Yung at this point. And they'll make clearer what the general outline that I've suggested is. Make punishments heavy and rewards light, and the superior will appear benevolent. That's a curious proposition, but he asserts this on the basis of his experience. And the people will die for him if the punishments are heavy. Make rewards heavy and punishments light, and the superior will not appear benevolent, and the people will not die for him. I'd be interested in bringing Sun Yung together with B.F. Skinner at this point, if you know something about B.F. Skinner's theory of enforcement. A theory of reinforcement, in his psychological theory. Skinner is constantly arguing, of course, that what we today would call rewards, or what Sun Yang would call rewards, are a much more powerful device for reinforcement than are punishments. Sun Yang takes the reverse position. Now the purpose then of the prince, if he's going to give vent to the energy, the natural energy of the people, is to conquer the world. This is his purpose. And this must be read as the implicit purpose of every state, to dominate the world. In seeking to dominate the world, Sun Yang suggests, order will arise within the state. In a sense, he's simply codifying an old proposition in the history of politics, that if you want obedience within a state, one way to get it is to divert attention to some foreign adventure. So that if you're poverty stricken, call attention to the fact that you're a member of a state which dominates the world, and this inflates your ego, as we might put it today, and you forget your poverty. Our rulers for thousands of years have been aware of this principle. It wasn't invented in the 20th century. Now, if one state practices my theory, it will be the only strong nation in the world. If two states practice my theory, war and strife may be a little lessened. If the entire world practices my theory, the golden age will return to us once more. Now, I gather from that last statement in the context of Sun Yang, the entire world practices the doctrine, the golden age will return to us once more. That he's saying that if every state is in tension with every other state and seeking to dominate, and they do it with about equal skill, you have a kind of balance of power which produces what he would say the golden age. This is the most you can expect from human beings, the notion of a balance of forces. And forces are represented primarily by military forces. In the process, therefore, his argument is, fighting may be abolished by fighting. And therefore, it's justifiable to fight. He's obviously talking against some of the Taoists, who are very close to a pacifist position. Fighting may be abolished by fighting. We had to destroy the city in order to preserve it, as the American general put it. You see how antique this notion is. Killing may be abolished by killing. The more severe you are, the more you apply the death penalty, then it is justifiable to kill. One last fling at killing will prevent killing for the future. It's amazing how Sun Yang's ideology permeates much of the thinking both of the East and of the West. Obviously, the propositions which I've just enunciated from Sun Yang run through both the history of China and the history of Western culture. One of the key propositions in Western political thought that is still, I should say, predominant, despite all our disillusionment with 20th century warfare, is the notion that you can get peace from war, which is exactly what Sun Yang is suggesting. One last battle, the capital O and the capital L and the capital B, and peace will be brought about. You can trace this notion far back to the Egyptians and the Chinese. Sun Yang simply gives it expression. Of course, in Western Christian political thought, it's going to be baptized and given the sanctity of holiness. Sun Yang does not invoke the gods at this point. He simply asserts it as a matter which is derived from his own political experience. In short, the purpose of the state is conquest and the establishment of what he calls oneness within. That it's a kind of homogenized society which stops division of labor at fighting and farming. In other words, he's suspicious of further division of place. He doesn't go back to nature. You can't do that. But neither will he go the length of the Confucianist, you see, who will elaborate a very complex system of division of labor and then attempt to hold men together through the doctrine of ceremonial rites. When oneness is established, then the energy of the state is concentrated. When the energy of the state is concentrated, the state is powerful. When it is powerful and yet is able to use its power, it produces energy and provides a vent for it. Thus I say that state is powerful which always attacks others. How is it? When only one path is open to fame and position, and all other private roads are prohibited, the people will devote themselves entirely to what the government requires. Hence there is abundant energy. When there is abundant energy, it must seek some vent. You see, here you have a primitive version, in a way, of a kind of quasi-Freudian notion, in a way. You don't want to disperse your energy into many avenues. You don't want to sublimate it. You want to direct it to two functions, producing food for the soldier and producing the soldier to fight. This is clearly implied in his statement. When no vent is given to it, the people will fall back upon their selfish desires. When they fall back upon their selfish desires, the state is weakened. It only produces energy and does not provide an outlet for it. The notion of an outlet for energy through fighting runs all the way through his doctrine. Hence, I say, the state which attacks itself, if you don't attack others, you attack yourself. Those are the only two alternatives. The state which attacks itself is bound to decline. So, naturally, both the Taoists and the Confucianists swoop down upon poor Sun Yat. And his doctrine never becomes, perhaps, it certainly never becomes the central political doctrine of China. As a matter of fact, it runs quite against a major cultural tradition in China, which is to put, as I suggested before, this is largely from the Confucianist and the Taoist streams of thought, to put the profession of soldier at the bottom of all professions. And so in a sense, Sun Yat is atypical, but for that reason I thought it was important to bring him in to this discussion of time of troubles, political ideology. Now, let's summarize what we've said very briefly about ancient Chinese political thought and then try to connect it with, and to compare it, so to speak, with what is happening in roughly the same period in Egypt and in Babylonia. Because the roots of ancient political thought in the West, I suppose you could say, fragmentary as they may be, go back to Babylonia or Sumeria, which was its ancient name, and to Egypt. So you have, for example, Babylonia, the Babylonian tradition going back at least to 3500 BC, and perhaps much before that, because archaeologists and others are constantly pushing back our dates. So don't take most of these early dates too seriously. They're simply used as pegs on which to hang our thinking. The three views, then, that we've summarized in connection with China are, of course, the notion of a primitive nature which acts as a norm for art, which is the Taoist notion. Whether it's true or not doesn't make any difference. You see, whether he apprehends nature correctly, the point is he associates the Tao with something called a primitive nature. Not a developed nature, but a primitive nature, which is important to keep in mind that distinction. The Confucianist, whose emphasis is on a considerable development of civilization, and therefore of potential chaos, because all thinkers think of moving away from nature as being hazardous, moving away from primitive nature as being hazardous, and creating possibilities of chaos. The Greeks are going to think of history as chaotic, and the Chinese, in considerable degree, think in the same way. How do you overcome this possible chaos, then, is the problem of the Confucianist, you see, and as we suggested, he does it through this elaborate development of the doctrine
of ceremonial rites, which goes back long before Confucius simply codifies and expounds what is a very old conception in Chinese history. And finally, then, of course, the third answer was given by Chanyang: limit the movement from nature. You can't reverse it. Limit it to two occupations, the division of labor, because this problem of moving you see away from nature is always a problem of division of labor. All the political philosophers, I think, recognize this implicitly. And then exalt the principle of physical force under the command of the sovereign, with the notion of a constantly attempted expansionist policy in order to keep the chaotic tendencies of history at bay internally. These are the three answers then that the ancient Chinese suggest for us. It would be interesting then to see how these doctrines, these basic doctrines, will relate to the origins of political speculation in ancient Egypt, for example, and what fragmentary remains we have of political speculation in the Middle East, that is, in Babylonia and Sumeria. And I want us to turn to that task now, and since we won't be able to finish what we have today, I'm going to have to take Friday yet to finish this discussion of Egyptian politics and the attempt to reconstruct it. But before we move into this subject, I think it's only fair to pause for a moment and see whether you have observations or questions that you'd like to raise. Individual freedom is not treated at great length unless you wish to identify to some degree with Lao Tzu. In some measure, Lao Tzu, you see, is protesting against what he thinks of as the destruction of individual autonomy, although I think we have to be careful about saying that too strongly, because he doesn't stress freedom so much. He does stress simplicity, and perhaps you can associate simplicity with freedom in the sense that the more hostages you give to fortune in a complex society, the less free you will be. This is part of what he says. That is, the more you move away from nature, the more you're dependent on other human beings before your very existence, on the bureaucracy of the corporation or the duke or whatever it might happen to be. And the less, presumably, you're master of your own destiny. And this, of course, parallels to some degree Jefferson's speech. In fact, Jefferson is sort of secondhand, four-time removed, in some respects, to the early Jefferson, is over against the later Jefferson. Chanyang, it seems to me, has no respect for the notion of freedom in almost any of its definitions. Of course, one of the problems of freedom is how you define it. Confucius, as I would infer, you can infer something of a doctrine of freedom, and that if one internalizes, you see, the rights that are external, one is free from one's undue passions or undue desires. Lao Tzu wants to abolish desire, Confucius wants to regulate it. And if you internalize the regulation, then presumably you are free from your desires, in that sense of the term free. Now Plato's going to take up that theme and of course elaborate it much, much more than Confucius does.
Would it result in like the greatest amount of fear, the greatest number of people? By internalizing this?
I don't think Confucius discusses it in those utilitarian terms. As far as I can see. That is, he has no Benthamite fallacific calculus. The greatest good for the greatest number of people. He doesn't think, perhaps in terms of individuality, nearly as much, well, certainly he doesn't, but nearly as much as, for example, the late 18th century and early 19th century thinkers, some of them do. So I think we have to be wary of too many direct comparisons. Empire.
Domination. Then disintegration, sometimes for a long period of time. And then empire, and then disintegration. This is a well-known pattern in Chinese history. And the time of troubles is just one of the most prominent epochs in that disintegration. Any of them do. I shouldn't be surprised if Chanyang does at some point. But I can't say. I just don't recall whether they do that or not. Wouldn't surprise me. Because what's amazing about the ancient Chinese political thinkers the anticipation of so many problems that we think of modern.
Malaria spraying. also their mosquitoes have become resistant. Nevertheless, it is true that in some countries, mosquitoes have become resistant because of agricultural spraying. On the other hand, FAO says, no, we absolutely cannot give up DDT. We must use it. It is particularly good for those people in the third world who are starving. So we are caught in this kind of a thing. WHO is spraying inside the huts of every peasant farmer in the third world. The FAO, on the other hand, takes care of the outside, the free environment, by spraying that. So we're covered inside and out by two specialized agencies, or more generally, by agricultural agencies and by WHO, both of whom got their ideas based on, I maintain, erroneous scientific information and ideology, which came after World War II. In between these two is caught the people of the third world, who inside their houses they're sprayed with DDT, and outside their houses they're sprayed with DDT and parathion and everything else. And this sort of thing, I believe, is the meaning of the exploitation of people. And it's intimately related to the kind of development that's going on. And I maintain that the same pattern is true in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, and the same pattern is true in the underdeveloped parts of the United States and Western Europe. And I think that my Indian friends here and others will be able to refer to that topic.
The exploitation of people, of my people anyway, has been going on for some time, since the invasion of Canada by the Europeans. Our people still live somewhat in a hunting society and a gathering society. They are not in tune with the European concept of the market society. We are being exploited by industry, by the educational system, by the political system, and by any means that can be thought up by the so-called ruling class in Canada. We are being exploited by them. Let me give you just a short, like when the Europeans first came to our country, they took advantage of the hospitality of the native people, because we had no concept of the ownership of land. We never had built a fence in our life. Our people moved just a little ways to allow the Europeans to settle. And they were so paranoid about their position in Canada at the time that they built forts and kept our people out, that they built a piece of Europe on our shores, because they could not relate to our society. So they brought missionaries, the Jesuit missionaries came and introduced religion into our people and taught us fear. We never had any fear of Manitou. In our religion, it's all love and understanding. There was no hell. And thereby exploiting the mentality of the people, they thought that if these guys have all these weapons and machines that they brought with them, they must know what they're talking about. So they seduced our people into leaving their way of life and becoming farmers and what we call hanging around the fort Indians, taking handouts and saying, look, if you just stay here, we'll feed you, but in the meantime, we'll be out behind your back taking your land. And this is one of the main concerns of my people anyway, the non-treaty and mixed bloods. We are fighting for to retain what we have left in Canada, although according to the laws instituted by the people in Canada, we have no rights, haven't any rights. They exploited our people through the fur trade. Our people only took as much as was needed, but then they started getting because of the need for fur in Europe, our people went out and raped our own country of its fur, almost decimated whole species of fur, fur-bearing animals. Today, we have industry moving in to the north of Canada, and they have a concept they call the Mid-Canada Corridor, by which they're going to develop a certain section of Canada. It's about from the 54th parallel to the 60th, or the 55th parallel to the 60th, and through northern Ontario and Quebec, and right across the Three Prairie provinces into British Columbia and the Yukon and parts of the Northwest Territories. Mining, oil, timber, tourism, and dams are things that they are using to fight our people with now, and legislation. They passed in Alberta what they call Bill 66 and Bill 67. And this restricts our people in how and where we can live and where we can move in the province. They said it was, these things were instituted to apply to everyone. But I can't go into all these bills, but in effect, they were passing bills and legislation to further suppress our people, because they had given us certain rights to our brothers and sisters in the treaties, under those treaties. And
nature has a limited capacity, different for every particular region, to act as a purification plant taking care of the wastes. The only way to prevent damage to the system is the introduction of man-made technical purification and recycling. Both alternatives in their term demanding more energy. Again, the necessity of balance between pollution and energy supplies and needs is shown, and we cannot escape working out an immediate energy planning on international level. The general demand for good environment also concerns working and hunting conditions. This is an aspect to the recommendations that has become particularly important in my country. And the workplaces, particularly in the factories, we can recognize many of the problems occurring in the general environment, but in a concentrated or amplified form. It is important that we recognize the need for international action for a better working environment. A special report on this subject has been published as part of the Swedish Preparatory Work. We will welcome any additional effort that international organizations could give to the problems of the working environment, paying particular attention to the interdependence between the working environment and the general physical environment. I hope that other delegations share our views and that this could be reflected in the report of the conference. This conference will, I hope, represent a breakthrough for giving to future international action in this field a common outlook and direction. The principle will be established that we all carry a common responsibility and must not act without regard for the interests of others. Thus, the ground is laid for the creation and the functioning of some international machinery in the environment field. We feel that the proposals for the setting up of such a machinery are among the most important projects of this conference. Part of this project is an environmental fund. The Swedish government has already taken the decision to contribute to this fund the sum of $5 million for the period due. The history of international cooperation has always been a careful balancing act, Mr. President, between national independence and international interdependence. How much national sovereignty are we in each instance prepared to give up in the interest of interdependence and international solidarity? In the field of environment, the case is in some respects more simple. The air we breathe is not the property of any one nation. We share it. The big oceans are not divided by national frontiers. They are our common property. What is asked of us is not to relinquish our national sovereignty, but to use it to further the common good. It is to abide by certain agreed international rules in order to safeguard our common property, to leave something for us and future generations to share. If we manage our own national environment in a sensible way, we are not only contributing to the well-being of our own people, we are giving proof of international solidarity. This simple fact is giving a new dimension to the concept of national sovereignty and to the common work for peace. In the field of the human environment, there is no individual future, neither for human beings nor for nations. Our future is common. We must share it together. We must shape it together.